Welcome to another edition of SCOTUSCast. Last week, the U.S. Supreme Court in Ledbetter v. Goodyear clarified lower court confusion concerning the statute of limitations and a salary discrimination claim. In this episode of SCOTUSCast, Jones Day partner Michael Carvin comments on the significance of this decision.
Hi, my name is Michael Carvin, and in the interest of full disclosure, I should make it clear that I was counsel for Goodyear in the Supreme Court on this case. Basically, the issue in this case was very straightforward. It was whether a female employee could sue for alleged salary discrimination when the alleged discrimination had occurred many years before the statute of limitations had expired. The argument was that the salary discrimination claim was still viable because she continued to receive paychecks which reflected the discriminatory decision that allegedly occurred years before. Specifically, Ms. Ledbetter, the plaintiff, claimed that she had been paid less beginning in the early 1980s because of a supervisor there who had discriminated against her. But she never sued or complained to the EEOC until 1998. So for a long time she was aware of this alleged discrimination, and yet she never complained about it until she was about to leave the company in 1998. At that point, Goodyear argued that the claim was stale. The Supreme Court issued a decision on this case in a 5-4 decision authored by Justice Alito. He made the very straightforward point that the statute of limitations must be measured from the time of the unlawful employment practice. The unlawful employment practice alleged here was a decision to pay women less because they were women, which was a violation, supposedly, of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. But since that unlawful discrimination had occurred many years before, it was no longer timely in 1998. The paychecks were not in any way discriminatory because those were neutrally issued by a computer which didn't pay any attention to gender or anything like that. The only thing that the paycheck was a continuing effect of a prior unlawful act, i.e. the previous discrimination. In a series of cases involving layoffs and firings and discrimination in seniority systems, the court had made it quite clear that you needed to bring your challenge when the discriminatory decision was made, not wait until it had an effect on you many years down the road. Thus, for example, if you were discriminatorily excluded from a seniority system, you couldn't wait until seniority affected your pension or something like that. You had to bring it when the decision was made. A college professor was told that he was going to be laid off at the end of the year. He alleged that that was for racially discriminatory reasons, but he should have challenged the decision when it was made, not when it was implemented later and he was laid off. The court made the point that there's nothing in the statute or in common sense which says that pay discrimination is different from all these other forms of discrimination, so it should be judged in precisely the same manner. It distinguished an earlier decision called Bazemore, which created confusion in the lower courts, on the grounds that what was involved in the Bazemore decision was a racially dual segregated system which continued in effect. In other words, they did have a discriminatory structure in place that did pay people less because of their race. So the paychecks, the implementation of that discriminatory decision, was implementation of a discriminatory system. Here you had a concededly non-discriminatory system by Goodyear, where one supervisor had apparently made, or allegedly made, discriminatory decisions. That decision, which was over 15 years old by the time the EEOC charge was filed, couldn't be challenged at that late date because there was nothing in recent history which had reflected any kind of adverse impact on the basis of gender. The dissenting opinion by Justice Ginsburg for herself and three other justices essentially made a policy argument that Pay discrimination was more difficult to detect than discrimination in promotions or layoffs or other sorts of things, and that therefore there should be a different rule for discrimination involving salaries than there was for all other kinds of discrimination. The court responded that Congress had made no distinction between salary discrimination and other forms of discrimination in the statute or in the legislative history, and that any kind of policy argument along those lines was better directed at the legislature than at the court. In terms of the future significance of this case, I think it is significant because there had been tremendous confusion in the lower courts about what kind of standards to apply in figuring out when to measure the timeliness of a claim of salary discrimination. Again, that confusion stemmed from a misreading of the Bazemore decision, which was based on entirely different facts. So the court has clarified that the same timeliness rules that apply to all forms of discrimination also apply to pay discrimination, and that should have an effect on the timeliness of discrimination claims brought by individuals or by groups of minorities or women plaintiffs. There's also been an effort in Congress, as I understand it already, to begin thinking about changing the law to implement the dissenting opinion's view of the situation. In terms of the policy benefits of that kind of remedial legislation, there's two very significant issues to be considered. In the first place, if you really did allow people to continue to bring sex discrimination claims every time they received a paycheck that allegedly was smaller than it would have been because of gender-based discrimination, you would be placing employers at extraordinary disadvantage in litigation. Again, the facts of the Ledbetter case itself illustrate that an employee could simply sit on their rights for 15 years, worry about discrimination that occurred in the 1980s and not complain about it until the 1990s. At that point, the employer obviously is very disadvantaged in terms of going back and reconstructing what happened trying to figure out what was going on. In the Ledbetter case, for example, the supervisor who had allegedly discriminated against Ledbetter was deceased by the time of trial, so you can't go back and get his version of events. More importantly, literally every time somebody's given a salary appraisal or a year-end review that affects compensation, under the regime contemplated by the dissenting opinion, employers would need to go back 15, 20, or more years and figure out whether or not it was even arguable that discrimination had seeped into the process. Now, obviously, that's just not a realistic possibility for employers, and you're putting them in a situation where they need to be able to conduct a business in an orderly manner and not hold a series of mini trials every time they're trying to give across-the-board pay raises or performance bonuses. And that, of course, was the principal motivation behind having a relatively limited statute of limitations under Title VII. Congress recognized that employers need to run their business and that employers should be able to correct discrimination problems without litigation if the employee brings it to them in a timely manner. So in other words, Congress wants to encourage people to bring discrimination to the employer's attention because the vast majority of employers, if there's any merit to the complaint, will be happy to solve the problem. Moreover, it's empirically dubious that discrimination in pay is really different in kind from other kinds of discrimination. In certain circumstances, it may be more difficult to detect. But as we know from common sense, many employees have a good idea of what other employees are making if they're in similar job categories. And, of course, the wrath of pay discrimination cases that are brought every day in federal courts makes it clear as can be that employees are able to detect salary discrimination. Indeed, in the Ledbetter case, it was not at all clear why she was able to so confidently assert salary discrimination in the 1990s if she had been unable to detect it in the 1980s. In other words, a salary discrimination claim presupposes that the employee will know about it. And there's no reason to think that the employee will know about it 10 years down the road if they don't know about it at the time. So you're really not aiding employees, and you're putting employers in a very difficult position if the rule in Ledbetter versus Goodyear were to be overturned. But absent such congressional action, this will be a very helpful clarification for employers and employees on what their rights and responsibilities are under Title VII. Thank you.